low battery on.
It says low battery.
That's not so good sign.
Mine says mute too, that's amazing. Now this one should be working.
Now, this is working.
Okay, you can begin with that and give that one to me, maybe.
All right, we're gonna start now. Individuals online, and this is being recorded. It's my privilege to present Professor Emeritus Bud Larson, who will be giving you a lecture on system thinking. Professor Larson's been in the business, and both the business and academic fields, for a long time. And what you will see as you get longer and longer in the business is the more and more you need systems thinking. And the material that you have for the course, there's he's presenting from his textbook. That's we're privileged to have the first chapter, and I'm going to be requiring an exam in you on the first chapter. So some of the material in the first chapters will be in the exam. So make sure that that's always the only way you get them to read it. It has to be in the exam. So there will be a question on the first chapter in the exam. But you're not here just to pass tests. You're here to learn something, and I'm sure that Professor Larson can give you some good insights into systems thinking. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Stuart. Happy to come to your small town in Norway, and those who are remote, welcome to the lecture as well. And so I'm going to talk about actually more than just systems thinking. It's going to be about systems thinking and to some extent systems engineering, because it's important that not we just think, that we also learn to act. And so it's a combination of the two, basically. And I'll try to, I've labeled the seminar Attaining a System Perspective, and it's based around this book, as Stuart mentioned, A Journey Through the Systems Landscape, which is I've been working on for several years and reflects my understanding of systems thinking and systems engineering, and also a lot of practical experience. I've been working earlier in the computer industry since 1959, and then I have worked in various applications of computers, and both in embedded systems of various varieties, and also later on in complex systems in general, which has spurred me to think. In fact, I'm editor for a book series on systems that's run by College Publications in the UK at King's College. So there's two other books. One is A Discipline for Mathematical Systems Modeling, which is, and then the other one is called Beyond Alignment, Applying Systems Thinking and Architecting Enterprises. So we're collecting books in the area, and there's a couple more in the pipeline that are coming out. Okay, if you want to, during the break, you're quite welcome to have a look at these books. Okay, well, what are we trying to attain? The purpose and goals of this: for all the participants, to expand your personal vision. I want to convince you that you can expand your thinking in new directions, and I think that will be quite fruitful. So the goal is to gain an appreciation. I have another slide where I say understanding, but since it's a shorter lecture, one will have an appreciation more than an understanding. And I think hopefully that will give you some inspiration maybe to read further on my book and to read some of the other sources of materials that we refer to. But we want to gain an appreciation of what it means to think in terms of systems, what it means to act in terms of systems, and particularly the change management of systems, for the thing we do with systems most is change them. And this is a really serious problem in our society. But it's an important aspect to have control over change management. And then an important part is when you're designing and developing systems, we have to think about the life cycle management of various types of systems, both physical systems, technical, and even non-technical systems for that variety. Okay, as I said, the primary source is my own book, but there are other sources like the Fifth Discipline book, developed by MIT professor Peter Senge, and the book Systems Thinking, Coping with 20th Century Problems, Boardman and Saucer. There's also books by other people that have contributed to system science, systems thinking, and systems engineering as well, which are quite appropriate for that matter. Some particular additional references, which I will be referring to, is an international standard, ISO IEC 15288, which has to do with software life cycle processes. I happen to be in the head of the Swedish delegation to that particular standards effort and was elected architect of the standard, so I have quite a deep knowledge of that particular standard, which has infiltrated in the world of systems engineering. Then there's another standard on architecture description, and I would suggest that you do a web search on systems thinking, and sometime you have systemic thinking as well. There's also a systems engineering body, a knowledge set of wikis, which are very important. But before we go into structuring that, why do we need a holistic perspective? Let's consider two train accidents that actually happen. And try to understand a broader perspective related to those train accidents. The first one was a freight train with liquid petroleum gas that crashed in Borlänge in Sweden in April of 2000. And the second was more local. A wreck at Ørsta station near Elverum in Norway earlier that year. Okay, now, I bring this up because I have particular knowledge. In the late 70s, I was the architect of the automatic train control system that sits on the locomotives in Sweden and in Norway. So I know a lot about how that control system works. And the design, the control system works that there's transponders out on the track, and as the train comes along, it picks up signals from the transponders and then calculates whether the train driver is abiding by speed limits and also with the status of signals as it's being passed, etc., and gives the information, and if the train driver does not react, it takes over control of the train and stops it. Okay, so that's one of a very simple explanation. There's obviously a lot more. But the system was designed in the late 70s. Actually, the design and the software was verified by people at Trondheim. incidentally enough, was interesting. And the system has worked on the Swedish railways and for over 30 years. Same architecture, same solution. So, though it's been updated for more recent versions later on in the around the year 1990, etc. Okay, but let's look at some aspects of these two train wrecks. The Borlänge train wreck. There were six freight cars filled with liquid petroleum gas that derailed and tipped over at 70 kilometers an hour in Borlänge. There was a speed limit in this area was 40 kilometers. And it was in the Borlänge station area, which happens to be, rather strangely enough, in front of the old Banverket, which was the train authority for Sweden, right in front of them. Okay, so It was an interesting situation that happened just there. Now, the station and the central Borlänge were declared off-limits for the public. About 650 were evacuated from their homes while the train was emptied of its contents. So nobody knew whether it would explode or not. And they have to be very careful about taking it out of there. Now, the way the ATC, the automated train control system, works is if the train stops, the driver can override it and drive further. So there's an interesting situation, though, that there was a decision made to save money that in the station areas of certain stations in Sweden, that they didn't have to put police as infrastructure in the station area, because obviously they assume that the train driver coming into a train station will slow down. Okay. So an economic decision was made, saving some hundred thousands of Swedish crowns, to not put police into the station area. And there's several stations. Obviously Stockholm has police, several on all the tracks coming in and out, but several places out in the country did not have this. So it was an economic decision. However, the train was stopped outside three times. And then, as I mentioned, the ATC infrastructure does not cover Borlänge itself. So there was not these balises in the train station area. So the driver thought, as he passed through this restrictive signal, and which the train derailed. So he didn't abide even by the visual signal. He just drove in at 70 kilometers an hour. And the switches were designed for 40, so it crushed the switch. Okay, and the train derailed. Now, turned out that the driver was drunk. And the test showed he had 1% per mil alcohol in his blood. So he didn't care. It turns out further that in the investigation related to this, that he had a friend on the train and he let his friend drive the train, which is not allowed at all. You have to be qualified to drive the train. So he got fired, obviously. But there's some interesting aspects of this, because even though you design a technical system that works, and ATC worked exactly as it was supposed to do, it doesn't no guarantee that you will not have problems, because you have to think about other aspects. Here's a human aspect, right? And there's also a financial aspect, right? Had they had balises in the train station area, so it wouldn't have happened either. So there's many things to think about, many aspects of complex systems that we have to deal with. At Oster Station here in Norway, 19 people were killed and several more injured when the express train from Trondheim to Oslo, carrying 83 passengers, collided head-on with a local train carrying 17 passengers heading from Hammer to Rena. The Norwegian National Rail Association says the probable cause was a northbound train passing the main exit signal at Rusta station while it was showing reds. That wouldn't have happened if the proper infrastructure was in place, because these balises are placed by the signals, and the train, the ATC, would have picked up the signal. Now, the interesting situation, a balise is a transponder. It gives the radio signals into the locomotive. Sorry.
So we have questions.
Okay, sure, absolutely. A balise is a transponder. Okay. So the trains, now it turned out both trains had the ATC on the locomotives. But the problem was that the permanent infrastructure along the stretch track on the Røros line was not equipped with this system. So the infrastructure was not in place. A few months later, it would have been in place. So the total system was not in place, so this is a result of the accident. So we can draw a little bit of conclusions about the need for holistic perspective on control. That safe train control involves many aspects, both technical and non-technical, including strategic planning, finance, resource allocation, human factors, management, administration, maintenance, training, and education. These are all systems themselves, right, that have to be working in order to have the whole ATC system working properly. And if you don't pay attention to all of them, you can indeed get problems. So getting this holistic perspective involves the use of systems thinking to build and analyze models of identifying and relating important multiple technical and non-technical aspects, problems, and opportunities. So this is one reason why we want to get this broader perspective, so we can analyze it in a more complex situation. Then it involves prudent decision-making in all aspects. Involves the use of systems engineering in respect to life cycle management of the system assets. It doesn't make sense to have assets on the track if they're not working because the maintenance has been poor. Or the ATC system on the locomotives is not maintained properly. So we have to think about the life cycle management of the system assets. So all the stakeholders involved, and there are many, must develop the capability to think and act in terms of systems. And that's my message, and I'm going to give you an approach to being able to do that. So it also applies to the treatment of information, and especially to information security. We could probably set up the same number of issues related to strategic planning, finance, resource allocation, human factors, management, administration, maintenance, training, and education, catastrophe procedures, laws, and regulations, and more. So all of these are things that would affect information security as well. And Stuart has a model of dealing with this in terms of the socio-technical system model. And this is a little clip about socio-technical systems, because that's what the ATC system is. It's not just a technical system. Okay, it's in by its nature a socio-technical system. Systems are in use are not simply technical but socio-technical. They involve the interacting communities that include technical, human, and organizational elements. Social-technical systems include people and processes as well as technological systems. The process definitions outline how the system designers intend the system to be used, but in practice, users interpret and adapt them in unpredictable ways, depending upon their education, experience, and culture. Individual and group behavior also depend upon organizational rules and regulations, as well as organizational culture, or the way things are done around here.
Okay.
Or not done. And this was taken from an article by Ian Somerville, who's written a rather important book about software engineering, which is published around many worlds. And I just met up with him after we met in the 70s, but I met him last year in St. Andrews, as a matter of fact. Okay. So we're talking about socio-technical systems, whether we're talking about information security or regulation or whatever. We could put that in. Certainly an airplane is a socio-technical system as well, isn't it? Okay, so any types of that. Now, we've had this, I think, in the area of information security, that's interesting to think about the fact that who is watching and who's manipulating information. Okay, now, this site comes from Thomas Jefferson in the late 1700s, which was rather insightful, but very modern. The two enemies of the people are criminals and the government. So let us tie down the second with the change of the Constitution so the second will not become a legal version of the first. So that's a rather insightful observation already at the time the United States was born. Okay. I just was reading an article the other day where Mark Zuckerberg calls Barack Obama, and this is my own translation. It was in Swedish, the article I read, but in essence, it's stating the following. When our engineers labor to improve security, we assume that we are protecting users against criminals, not our own government. The American government should be a protector of the internet and not the threat. So that's certainly a pertinent observation in these days with social media and the heavy use of the internet. Another thing about this is the Stuxnet. This is related to the Stuxnet worm. Are you familiar with that? Okay, where they got into the program logic controllers dealing with the centrifuges in Iran. But I was picking up this quote someplace else. The sober reality is that the global scale, pretty much every single industrial or military facility that uses industrial control systems at some scale is dependent upon the network of contractors, many of which are very good at narrowly defined engineering tasks, but lousy at cybersecurity. Okay, so we get a very complex system with many suppliers, and this was thought that it was a Russian coming in with some type of USB stick and putting it into computer because they didn't have the internet connection, and eventually spread out the worm into the centrifuge control systems.
It just now became an electron, this USB stick lying on the thing. We don't know if we should plug it in or not.
Okay. But one can imagine the implications of this. This is not the question, but if we're now talking about an Internet of Things and we're going to have controllers for physical apparatus in our homes that are controlled remotely, etc., what are the implications of that? The problem is just beginning. There are serious problems, I think, about Internet of Things in the home. Both physical problems and also problems for sociological problems and other types of things, the psychological problems that could arise in the homes, etc. So there's a number of things, I think, to think about. And certainly I would say that your program in information security is very important. Okay, this is certainly the future that we have to think about, how we're going to attack these problems. I will point out tomorrow, I'm giving a lecture, some historical problems. Life would not have to been as complex as it is today in the computer technology. Okay, but we'll take that up a bit more tomorrow, those who have the time to attend that. Okay, so we have these serious problems, and we need to get the holistic perspective of the many views, the many aspects of this that are going to create this. Now, I was reading an interesting book that was written in 1989 by Richard Saul Werman called Information Anxiety. Has anybody read that book? Okay, it's an interesting book to read from a historical perspective. I read it about 10 or 12 years ago. And I liked the book because it talked about information anxieties produced by the ever-widening gap between what we understand and what we think we should understand. It's the black hole between data and knowledge, and it happens when information doesn't tell us what we want or need to know. Now, that was interesting perspective in 1989. What's the perspective about information today? Anybody have any thoughts about that? What has happened? I mean, we had this fantastic explosion of the internet and Google and other types of things. I don't get anxiety related to the fact that I don't have access to information anymore. Do you get that? Do you get anxiety to say, well, there's much more that I should know than I can gain access to? It's an interesting question.
Well, in a sense, it's interesting with the Google glasses. What were they? Would they help the anxiety or create more anxiety?
Okay.
The question also is when you would know it.
Yeah. Right.
Everybody knows that the information is out there. It's just how do you get it?
Well, yeah, but it's become much easier to get nowadays than it was ever at this point in time, 1989. So it's an interesting time perspective, because I think personally that people's attitude toward information has changed since then. Okay. But they may have anxiety, and certainly I was looking at a experiment called the Helsinki Privacy Experiment. I could recommend you have a look at that on the internet if you are not familiar with that, where they tried to instrument some homes and with cameras and all these sources of things that people could be watching, right, and getting information about you and your family. And that's the problem. Okay, I would have more anxiety related to the access of information that I don't want people to have access to than anything else. But it was an interesting, I just thought it was an interesting perspective to take this up. Okay, so what we're going to be doing the rest of the lecture is traveling in the systems landscape. And that's why I called the book A Journey Through the Systems Landscape. And what I've tried to develop this as a journey through 8 stations of knowledge, some introduction about systems, thinking in terms of systems, acting in terms of systems, dealing with system descriptions and instances of systems, dealing with change management, life cycle management, data, information, and knowledge, and then finally coming up at looking as organizations and enterprises as systems as well. So taking this trip, I think, gives a perspective. Each chapter ties up with a knowledge verification section where I try to ask questions, but I try to present this as a holistic perspective. And in the middle is the change management model, which we continually evolve, because, as I said, the most important thing about dealing with systems is change. And we're not very good about that in many cases. Okay, now I'm going to not go into the whole of chapter one, but I want to point some highlights about that, which will be interesting, and maybe some of the questions that Stuart will pass on to will be taken from this material. I don't know, but we'll see. Anyhow, okay, what I've tried to do is, this word system is a problem, okay? Because in whatever language around the world, there's a corresponding word for system, and people use and misuse it. More typically, we typically bring it up when something fails, and we said there's a system failure, right? When there's no other rational explanation. Okay? And that's very abstract, isn't it? Okay? There's a system failure. That could be anything, right? If we're going to use the word system in some positive sense, we need to be able to get some reasonable semantics for it. So that's what chapter one has tried to do. I've tried to put a perspective where you can look at aspects of systems which will give you some meaning behind this word system. And it winds up at the end of chapter one with what I call the system survival kit. Okay, how we survive in the world of complex systems. Okay, and so we take up various aspects about systems in this chapter. The first aspect we take up is the question of togetherness, which is the most fundamental system concept. This was pointed out in a book by John Boardman and Brian Saucer. We believe the essence of a system is togetherness, the drawing together of various parts and the relationships they form in order to produce a new whole. Now, if we interpret that, what's going on at the moment? A system, right? Well, I'm conveying hopefully some knowledge to you, right? And you are elements in a system, right? Okay, so we could have a very, very broad interpretation of this because we're together. Okay, so togetherness is the most fundamental property. And this really gives impetus to the statement made by one of the founders of the area of system science and systems thinking, Ludwig Wertenlaffy, began already in the 1920s. So it implies a very broad view of systems. And Wertenlaffy said, systems are everywhere. And they're here. Okay, or anywhere else we go. So realizing that and seeing them in nature and man-made systems gives us a broader perspective. Now, so if you do that and do something more concrete about understanding and give meaning to systems, then you can use it in a positive way. Not just as an abstract idea, there was a system failure, right? Okay, so that's the purpose. So being that they're everywhere, they're certainly going to affect all disciplines, including information security. Okay, but any other discipline we would like to look at. Now, there's the interesting relationship to systems and the unification of disciplines, and we could look at some important scientific unifications. Newton, the unification of heavens and earth. He looked at a holistic perspective. Maxwell unified electricity and magnetism. Einstein, unified view of matter, energy, space, time, and gravity, several aspects dealing together, right? So what we really need to develop is an interdisciplinary unification on systems. And if we can do it, then we can improve the use of the word system in a very positive, concrete way. So that's what I'm really out after, is to unify the perspective on systems. Now, there's two other fundamental concepts that revolve related to it that we can apply in virtually any type of endeavor. And we can look at that both from a science perspective and an engineering perspective. We're always dealing with behaviors and structures. Okay? But they're really two sides of a coin. From a science point of view, we want to observe behaviors and develop and design means of description in the form of structures that can describe that behavior. Now, that's true of microbiology, it's true of physics, it's true of any other types of science. Okay, but as we see, that we can even apply it in certain other things in a few moments. From the engineering perspective, we want to use structures to help us design and develop systems that achieve behaviors. Okay, so we're really dealing with similar issues. And that observation is very interesting when we'll come and I've introduced a model that will unify both aspects of that in a few moments here. Okay, so we could then look at virtually any science or engineering discipline. And on the left side, and nowadays we talk quite a bit about data science and big data. And what are we doing? We're observing it, right? And trying to describe things, right? So that's very consistent with the scientific endeavor. But this doesn't just include physical sciences like biology, physics, and chemistry, but also environmental sciences, management sciences. Computer science is a little special case. Military science, system science, etc. Well, on the engineering side, we talk about information engineering, right? Okay, so we create information structures that are hopefully useful. Okay, so we find that these two aspects of both systems thinking and systems engineering can be related very neatly to this picture. It becomes clear that the work of all disciplines can be related to some aspect of systems. Thinking in terms of systems is highly related to observing dynamic behaviors of systems in operation. Thus correlates to this left-hand scientific side. And acting in terms of systems involves creating engineering structures of one or more systems that are of interest and thus corresponding to the right-hand side, engineering side. So that's why we need to be able to think about both. And they complement each other in an interesting way. Now we could have multiple views of systems, particularly man-made systems. Some people may look at a system as an asset, some look at it as a product, and some look at it as a service. An owner might have his particular view of that as an asset, the developer might look at it as a product, but the user is looking at it as a service. Okay? Now, that's one perspective on systems. The other perspective on systems is related to situations, because a situation typically involves togetherness, right? There are several things that have happened in this situation. And the situation could be related to somebody is responsible for the situation, somebody participates in the situation, or somebody could be influenced by the situation. So I did some deep thinking about the relationship between these things and came up with a model that I think is starting to be used by colleagues in other parts of the world who found that model to be useful. But the important thing before looking at the model, is that the fact that systems are developed and deployed in order to respond to both planned and unplanned situations. That's the only reason we have systems. Okay? Why do we create systems? Okay, well, we have a situation we like to attend. It might be a problem or an opportunity, right? Okay, so we create systems that allow us to deal with situations. And that's giving that perspective, you come up with what I call the universal mental model, which I call the system coupling diagram. Okay, and the system coupling diagram is composed of a situation system where some elements become related. That could represent a problem or an opportunity. We then build a respondent system, and the double bars indicate that these are interacts between the respondent system and the situation system. In executing the respondent system, we hopefully change the situation into a new situation. Consider a fire brigade, right? A fire brigade goes out to put out a fire. Okay, and that's the situation. And we build up the respondent system, and hopefully we change that to a situation that's under control. Consider developing a new nuclear facility. Okay, we have the same situation that we would need to respond to that opportunity and produce that. Now, in doing respondent systems, we are dependent upon the use of system assets. So the system assets we instantiate and bring into the respondent system in order to help us in the interaction with the situation. One of the typical elements that we bring over is a control element, which will regulate how we're going to make that response. So, we can always keep this model in mind because it will come back several times. Now, the interesting thing is, and why we have a lot of confusion in our world, is we give different names to these three things. Okay? And people talk about them as being completely unrelated and different. If we talk about situations, we could talk about natural situations, natural catastrophe, man-made, or mixed man-made and natural systems. And then I have another category, which I call thematic. And thematic is really a way of building up a postulated situation where we would like to study some type of response. For example, a military mission or a business game would be a good example of a thematic system.
An innovation project.
Or an innovation project. Yeah, that's exactly. So we could build a respondent system, and we might give them various names like project, program, task, mission, or experiment. When we utilize facilities, could be hardware, software, etc., we instruments, we apply theory, knowledge, methods, tools, and processes. We bring all these to bear around that. Now, it's interesting that the same model serves for both thinking and acting. So whether we're going to look at the situation to get a better understanding, we're still going to have to apply system assets, right? Which could be models, could be various types of theories, it could be physical facilities, etc. And acting, we're creating solutions that will change situations to new situations. So even when we later on we'll look at a life cycle management, as we move from a situation where we have a set of requirements to a design, to production, to use, etc., what are we dealing with? We're moving from situation to situation, aren't we? So the same model applies at various phases when we're dealing with that. We're applying different sets of assets.
Okay. We have this TV system here.
Okay, yeah. Thank you for the reminder. Okay. I tend to walk around quite a bit when I speak, so I feel like I'm having a street jacket on here, I guess.
It's so nice to
you. Okay.
Move this way.
Okay, all right. Well, okay, another aspect of thinking about the systems is that we need to be focused around systems and give them bounds. So Robert Flood and Eric Carson in 98 proposed this type of terminology. Whenever looking at a system, we could look at a narrow system, but there's typically a wider system around that that's going to may either support or interact with that in various ways. And they exist in an environment and maybe even in a wider environment. So as we're looking at any one of the types of systems that we're looking at here, we could apply this same thinking to the situation itself. Okay? The situation doesn't happen in isolation. There's wider systems that are affecting the environment, a wider environment. The respondent system, the same, and the individual system assets, the same thing. Or even if we want to draw the boundary, that our boundary is the situation and respondent system together as elements, right? That's going to also be implied this same model, etc. Or even a broader perspective around all the elements, all of the diagram. So focus is an important issue. Now, we use assets in an organization, and it's important that organizations and their enterprises that produce value added have some type of system focus in order to achieve their purpose, missions, and goals. Unfortunately, people do not have that in many large organizations. They think about functions and departments and other types of things. But what are they? Well, a department is a system, isn't it? Okay. A function is elements that interact together and produce something. So that's a system as well. So we can bring this system thinking into perspective for enterprises, and we'll do that a little bit later in the day. Some typical organization or enterprise system assets are value-added product, value-added service-related product and service, etc., enterprise operation, organization-related, or information-related. So all of these are instances of systems that are system assets. And these are just some example. Now, an enterprise exists to produce some type of value added, either product or service. So, okay, there are several other aspects that I take up in that chapter one, and I'm not going to go through them in detail other than to reflect, I guess that's readable, the fact that I've broken this down into what I call a system of system concepts, because the concepts themselves form a system, and actually I'm not the first person to use that term, system of system concepts. Russell Ackoff, who was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, used that several years ago as well. But I consider these concept categories to be important. Fundamental concept, we talked about togetherness, structure, behavior, and the related concept, of course, is emergence. When we put two things together, we get expected or even unexpected behaviors that arise as a result of emergence. Types, this is taken from Peter Checklin, who's also a contributor in the area, defined physical systems, defined abstract and human activity systems, and of course we could talk about mixtures of these, and certainly the social technical system is a good example of that. We can talk about topologies of systems, which we way to describe them as a hierarchy or as a network. That's another aspect. And then there's the aspect of complexity in systems. And a gentleman by the name of Weaver already in 1948 provided these classifications, at least the first of complexity, where we have organized simplicity organized, disorganized, and people-related. And certainly we get categories of the organized simplicity where we can identify a small number of factors. Now, I think this has really affected my thinking under my career, is don't make things more complicated than necessary. Okay, so certainly... and I've experienced that and used this several times. The automatic train control system working in your country and working in my country, the original version was 10K bytes of ROM code. That's not the loader, that's the whole system. I found a clever algorithm about how to deal with that problem. Okay? And so... that system is based around that thinking, and it's not very complicated. It's very simple. Okay, then we have another aspect, and that's the aspect of roles, which we've gone through. We talk about system assets, and I call them sustained system assets because it's important that we sustain the assets so that they're ready for use. It doesn't help if you have a tank in the military and it doesn't work because of maintenance when you have to use an instance of it, right? Okay, so you have to talk about sustaining system assets. Situation systems, respondent systems, and then we talked about thematic systems. So these set of aspects, which I put in the idea of a system of system concepts, together with the system coupling diagram, and then there's a set of principles, which are truths, which we can extract from this set of concepts. I won't belabor you with that, but they're in the book. I call that the system survival kit. So if you understand these aspects about systems, you have some concrete basis about thinking about the word system and not just in an abstract thing like system failure. Okay? So we have something we can build upon, and that's what we do. And so that's an important step, and as Stuart mentioned, you'll probably get a question about that somewhere from that chapter. Okay. Given that, let's move on. I think what we'll try to do is to go about 15 minutes or so and then take a break, if that's okay. Okay. Well, systems thinking is a process of discovery, an inquiry into the governing processes underlying the problems we face and the opportunities we have. And that's taken from MIT Professor Singer's book. Evolved during the 20th century, there were several pioneers, Ben Bertinelli, who we mentioned, Jay Forrester at MIT, Peter Senge, Peter Checklin, Russell Atkoff, Safra Beer, Wes Churchman, and there's a whole host of others. Systems thinking, can be looked as an essential part of the discipline of systems science and has a strong relationships to operations research and decision analysis, and is used in those areas as well. Now, according to Peter Senge, he defines it as a discipline for seeing holes, framework for seeing interrelationships, for seeing patterns of change rather than static snapshots, a set of general principles distilled over the course of the 20th century, spanning such diverse fields as physical and social sciences, engineering and management, but also a specific set of tools and techniques. Now, he has his own perspective about tools and techniques, and even the language, which we will look briefly about that. Other people have different approaches, so there is not one unified approach to systems thinking. Doesn't exist. People have built various types of things to address these problems and deal with them. So it's important to remember that there are different perspectives on systems thinking. Okay, but one of the important delineations that is important to understand is we can talk about hard and soft systems. Hard systems are characterized by the ability to define purpose, goals, and missions that can be addressed by engineering methodologies and attempting to some sense optimize a solution. Whereas soft systems are characterized by extremely complex, problematical, and often mysterious phenomena for which concrete goals cannot be established and which require learning in order to make improvement. But soft systems are not limited to social and political arenas, but also exist within and amongst enterprises where complex, often ill-defined patterns of behaviors are observed that are limiting the enterprise ability to improve. So all enterprises, large enterprises, tend to have these types of problems that come up. Now, how we address this? Well, the important thing is related to models and views. And as I mentioned, Stuart has a model, which he used to talk about social technical systems. And so models become quite important. And people will have different views based around their viewpoint. So one or more models will create views. And so this is important to remember that we have individual perspectives. But the important thing is system focus. Where is the problem or opportunity? And we could go back to our system coupling diagram. So, well, the problem's in the situation system. Or the problem is we don't have the right set of assets, right? Or the problem is we can't build a proper response. Or the relationship between the situation system and the respondent system, or the other respondent systems and system assets. It could be a set of problems or opportunities that we would like to study in relationship to this model. So that's an important aspect. So we could have some various approaches to doing that. So I'm just going to go through and list some examples of modeling methods, and then we'll look at some of them a little more specifically. One of them is quite simple. It's methodology is called finding root causes. And this is Peter Senge, who's created these two approaches. One is asking why a situation exists and getting the answer to that and say, why that? And go deeper and deeper in trying to find the root cause. I will give you a root cause tomorrow of why the computer industry has failed. Okay. We have failed to produce hardware and software that's usable. Okay. There was a point in time where that problem could have been solved, but there's a set of happenings that we could ask about that, which is a root cause. And another one is the problem is, which is really a brainstorming approach. But there are other techniques like influence diagrams. And then Peter Senge developed what he called the links, loops, and delay language, which is a way of describing the dynamic relationship between things. And we'll look at some examples of that. And then he has also developed what he calls archetypes, which are a way of looking at specific types of situations, okay, through the archetypes. Peter Checklin has talked about rich pictures, which try to elicit multiple or as many aspects as possible. There's also somewhat based around links, loop, and delay thinking, developed languages that are more used for dynamic simulation called Stella and iThink. So that's an important aspect. And then there's a methodology produced by Boardman and Saucer called systemograms. One may look at it somewhat as a bit more sophisticated entity relationship diagram. Okay, we'll look some examples of that as well. But it's been used and quite useful. There's a website about systems thinking and a free tool available. And if you'd like to go in, I can recommend to do a web search on Insight Maker. You can try out some models yourself. Okay, and create them and look at other people's models. Done by Gene Bellinger, amongst others. And then, of course, we have mathematical models, which can be used to describe complex situations as well. And in this second volume of the book, Discipline for Mathematical System Modeling, there's an approach using a programming language called Gnosis to describe simulation structures and also to make proofs about certain mathematical realities in complex situations. Gnosis has is a probably a third generation Simula product. And Simula, of course, started here in Norway. Okay, you're not aware of the Simula programming language? Simula was one of the early, actually was kind of the big origins of object-oriented programming, but was developed by Dahl and Nygaard in Oslo and at the Norwegian Computing Center. Okay. it had. I used to teach that in simulation classes, and it's quite good language and approach. But there's been further generation than at Calgary, for example, further developments in Canada by Bert Whistle, and these gentlemen are in the UK. Have done that. Actually, this is interesting from the perspective of these three gentlemen's work at the Hewlett-Packard Laboratories. And their use of this type is for information security. Okay, they want to prove certain aspects, and so there is a heavy information security aspect to their approach as well. So I can recommend that. But it's
what happens, as I say, this course is an introduction to systems thinking or social technical modeling. The idea is in the next course you would get it, and that would be offered to the management track.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, well, we're not going to go through. I'm going to give you a little bit about leaks, lumps, and delay and archetypes, a little bit about rich picture, stella, systemograms, and mathematical models, just to give you a flavor of some particular models. Okay, Senga's leaks, loops, and delay language. Well, let's say that particular example, we want to introduce a new system service to attract our customers, like your Google Assets, right? Okay. And by the introduction of new system services in our enterprise, this increases the workload for support personnel. So they are not able to support their customers pretty well anymore. So this could increase the customer dissatisfaction with the level of service, which after some delay might result in a reduction of the use of services, which is not at all one would have hoped to have done. So the sales volume actually reduces instead of increases. So this is something that related to providing a new service, but we also have support personnel. But there's just a few elements involved, but then you can deal with much more complex pictures. But the basic idea is telling a system story. You begin with some element of interest, and you relate that to a situation or action, which relates to another situation or action, etc. So that's the important aspect of telling the system story. So what it does is that there are certain types of relationships that get involved, and they are related to what we call growth loops and limiting loops. Growth loops are things that continue to expand, either in a positive or a negative sense. Things could be getting better or they could be getting worse. Okay? And limiting loops are things that cause things to come into balance. So, for example, if we had some idea in an organization improve the quality of services, and we allocate resources to improve those quality, and we get some improvements, well, we could continue to make situations to give further resources and hopefully make further improvements. But we'll run into some type of limitation by the complexity of the system issues and also the organizational capacity to increase. So this is a limiting factor, so we can't continually improve the quality of service. Okay, that's a very simple example. But Senga builds up what he calls archetypes, which are particular things that deal with particular types of situations. They're reinforcing loops, the growth loops, and balancing loops, the limiting loops. So we could get into certain situations where we have limits to growth. That's the one we looked at along the left-hand side there. We get into other types of structures which told tragedy of commons, which are people sharing resources and having problems with that. But basically the first category is whether we're looking at about dealing with growth or dealing with fixing problems. Along this fixing problems, we could have loops such as fixes that backfire. We have a situation, we make a change, and we get effect that we didn't expect. Okay, so these are various ways of bringing these into use. So these are quite useful structures that are provided as archetypes. Now, if you look at Senge produced his first book in the early 90s called The Fifth Discipline. And then there's the Fifth Discipline Handbook that came out a few years later that has a lot of case studies. It's a very thick book. And that's very useful to go through and look at some practical experience of people utilizing links, loops, and delays and archetypes. Okay, so that's one methodology. The next is rich pictures. And this is just making a drawing, basically. But what you're trying to do is to relate what are the elements of a situation and how they relate to each other. So this is related to juveniles in London and the all different types of factors that they're related to, both in transport, drugs, prostitutes, other types of things that can come up that affect their situation. So this is to call it juveniles at risk. And so you try to identify all the factors that deal with that. Actually, in my book, I have a rich picture, not this one, of a toy manufacturer and their problems with safety and other types of things. I drew that originally, then my daughter redrew it because I don't draw too well.
Well, I guess the question is now, would you want to do a rich picture exercise with your Google glasses?
That's an interesting question.
This doesn't take much formal knowledge.
Right.
It's a fancy word, rich pictures, but
right.
You have to decide if you want to introduce it. Now, what I usually did with security is I've done this type of rich pictures in cryptographic systems. And there, what I do is that when the keys are in clear text, I have that in green, and when they encrypt it in red, depending which one you choose. And then you can see exactly where the information is open or where the information is not.
Okay.
So when you're having... So sometimes what I do is I combine rich pictures with what we call signaling diagrams.
Yeah, I noticed they use that, right. Okay.
So that's another way of... But you guys can... These are ideas. You only have 2 weeks, so you don't have much time. 3 weeks.
Okay.
Just some ideas that you can read.
Okay. Okay, that might be a good place to take a 10-minute break, and then we'll march on. Okay?
So the video keeps on going, so you know. So take off your mic, because everything you say will be used against you.
Okay.
I almost went to the washroom with it all last time. So.
Okay.
So back in 10 minutes, or you can... Anybody can take...
You want to have a look at the books here. You're very welcome to do that.
And if anybody wants to remember idea, you can sign up for the Times on Sunday. Right. Send that out as an email. You got it.
Okay, let's continue on then and look at systemograms. The basic idea with systemograms, as I mentioned, is somewhat of a bit more sophisticated entity relationship diagram. In this particular systemogram, what Boardman and Saucer are relating to is the specific problems related to the intelligence community in the United States after 9/11. And they were talking about problems that we have institutional incapacities and that are created by certain types of sources. So on along the left side, we actually have a situation system along the left side, mostly in the red. In the middle, there's a respondent system, basically, about how to go about transforming that, and they call this the transformation program to deal with that. And the right is to developing the set of resources that are needed in the forms of assets. But if you go through this diagram, which we won't do in detail here, you'll find certain elements and relationships. And you can, as you see in the middle, we collect together a set of nodes in the diagram as well. So this is a useful approach to producing complex relationships. And this particular diagram, as I mentioned, deals with situation, response, and effect upon assets. This is a systemogram about documenting a system. You might find this to be useful in your project, okay? Because you're going to produce this product, the Google system. What do you need to be able to deal with that? Well, there are certain things that you need to identify with that that you're going to be important. This product is going to be viewed by an observer who creates a description of the product, which highlights perhaps conflicts, other types of things. So you might find this to be a useful diagram in trying to relate to a particular system of interest that you're concerned with. And think about the implications of that from multiple perspectives. Okay, another method is the so-called Stella and I think, which is an intuitive icon graphical simplified model building. They talk about flow of materials, and it's called the stock and flow diagrams, support a common language of systems thinking to provide insight into how systems work. And they have also some enhanced stock types for discrete and continuous processes that they talk about. So causal loop diagrams present the overall causal relationships. Model equations are generated automatically and made available beneath the model level. Oh, no idea.
Do you want to check the connection?
Something may have happened here. It disappeared there. Oh, it's up there. The problem is up there.
Never seen the beam go up. I think the bulb's not.
That's a possibility.
We have a situation here.
How are we going to respond to that? It looks like it may be coming back on. Ah, we're back in business. The interesting question is, why are we back in business and how do we do it?
While we cut down the distance. Yeah,
okay. I didn't see anything. It was you that saw it. Okay. Well.
Is anybody on the stream? Because my streaming is not working. Is your streaming working? Anybody streaming here?
Because I've tried the streaming in our lectures, but it was supposed to stream.
It didn't work when you tried it either. Okay, that's consistent. Sorry about that, bud.
Okay.
I'm just going to double check and see if there is anybody that I can keep it. Thank you. You can continue.
Okay. All right, well, back off here. The Stellan, I think, as I said, is based around stocks and flows, as we'll see. We use causal diagrams to represent overall causal relationships, and the mathematical models are generated and made accessible beneath the model level, and built-in functions facilitate mathematical, statistical, and logical operations. Arrays simply represent repeated model structures. So there's a methodology related to that. Here's a reference to their website. So we could be looking at some transactions to be processed by an organization. And you see that there's pipes and valves. So you can open and close by putting parameters on this, and things flow through the system as a result of that, and decisions can be made. And this is about transactions being processed by an organization, but it's about personnel and the people and burnout rates. They are not able to work much more. It died again. Well, I don't know what we'll do about that. Okay.
I
You just turned it off, I think.
Yeah, well, it's kind of slow in the response, it's all.
Sure.
I pressed several times.
Nothing happens.
It died again.
Because there's nobody that I can support.
The only thing we can do is see if we can get
another room.
That's a possibility. Or we get a projector, but I don't know if.
I will deal with it. I'll try to find somebody to deal with.
Okay. See what happens. No input is detected.
Well, we have K105 we can move into.
Oh. It started?
Yeah, but it's probably going to go back off.
Yeah, so I would be convening the room next door, okay?
Okay.
Now I'll just try and rebook the room. Can you just set up in the next?
Sure.
All right, everybody, K105. Why do you think it's going to go back again?
I don't know. Could it be?
Could it be? Well, the only thing I can think of is, I wonder if these remote controls are in different rooms. If someone turns off there, the signal of the phone here. You know what I mean?
No, we don't have to be in the board, but we're working something out because we need to usually only have the members that are in the
Sorry about that.
Sterling.
I'll go collect my other things, sir.
I think you should change the mic.
I'm sorry?
You should change the mic. This mic belongs to this.
Okay, probably so.
Thank you.
For those of you online, due to technical difficulties, we had to change the rooms. The projector wasn't working. So, as I say, when it comes to the course, the material here had to do with section one of Bud's chapter and the information on holistic. We capture this lecture again. We have a bit of a buffer zone in the fifth lecture, and I will cover the important aspects of systems thinking in that lecture. I apologize for any inconvenience this might have caused you. Thank you.